got miserable, then it was a lot worse. A few years ago, and I was sober maybe about 21, 22 years, I started to get a pain in my toe. And I suffer from a Raynaud's phenomenon. In the wintertime, my fingers and toes get really cold and they hurt. But this was my second toe, and it was different. It was a different pain. It definitely was not the Raynaud's. And I'm talking to my sister, and my dad had just passed away, and she was telling me about the gout and how he experienced it and the pain. And I said, "Well, boy, that's a lot like the pain I'm having." And she said, "Well, the pain was in his big toe." And I said, "Well, this is, you know, the second toe." So I do a little research on the internet, and it says, "Well, gout shows up primarily in the great toe, and it might show up somewhere else, but that primarily in the great toe." And so I say to myself, "Well, this is the toe right next to it. I must have gout." And the article says cherry juice, black cherry juice, is something that will help a lot with that. So I'm telling my wife about this, and she says, "Well, maybe you do or maybe you don't, but you got to go to the doctors. Give the doctor a chance, you know." And so I tell her, "Okay, all right, fine, I'll make the appointment." So I make the appointment to go to see the doctor. That morning, before I go, I think I'm going to just stop in Tops and see if they might have some black cherry juice. Well, wouldn't you know it, in the organic section, how can you go wrong? Right? They have black cherry juice. And so I see it, and it's a pretty decent-sized bottle, and I think, well, I'm going to probably need this, so I'd buy two bottles of it. So I go back to the office, and I start pounding this black cherry juice. Now, the pain's like going away. It's like a miracle. My God, it was killing me when I walked in the office, and now it's going away. So, and this is a lesson for all of you in sobriety, that if you're married, you really need to consult with your sponsor before you make certain calls. I'm driving over to the doctor's, and I decide, well, I'm going to call my wife. You know, I just tell her about this miraculous cure that I found. And, you know, God's with me. She doesn't answer. I get the answering machine. And I can't resist. I've got to tell her. You know, I'm going to the doctors. I'm going to spend the money on the copay. I can tell you right now, I got this black cherry juice. It's unbelievable. I feel terrific. I bet if I didn't see that doctor, I bet by tomorrow it would all be gone away. But I'm going to go anyway just because you want me to. Don't ever leave messages like that. That is acting on stinking thinking, and it's just a poor result. I get to the doctors. The physician's assistant comes in, take off my shoe, my socks. She takes a look at it. I say, "Well, doc, you know, I have the gout." She says, "You don't have the gout." And I said, "No, I'm righteous. What do you mean I don't have the gout? I'll tell you I do have the gout." She says, "That's not the gout." I said, "My father had the gout, and it's genetic, and I think she goes down, she just puts her finger on my toe, like I fly through the roof from the pain. She says, "That's not the gout, you have an infection." She gives me an antibiotic, and a week later the thing is cleared up. I somehow have to now go home and tell my wife that some idiot impersonated me on that phone call and left this message. Because I have just made the biggest fool out of myself, because I think I know what's better for me. So it doesn't necessarily go away because you've been a long time without a drink. So the acronym THINK, thoughtful, honest, intelligent, necessary, and kind. Do not say anything unless it's thoughtful, honest, intelligent, necessary, and kind. And if you do those things, you'll find that most of the stinking thinking and the effects of it go away. Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. Okay, I'm going to finish up on step six, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back. So, as Chuck said, it says in the 12 and 12 that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Could never figure that out. What does he mean by that? Until I had experience with the fifth step. And now I know what's on the shelf of my life. I know those resentments. I know those fears. I know those sexual dysfunctions. And now I got to do something about it? Yeah, well, here's my problem. I'm not drinking. I know I'm not the greatest person in the world. But I'm not drinking. Don't you get it? What would happen if all this person I am goes away? Who am I going to be? Am I going to be like a Hare Krishna on the corner? Is God going to have me doing something stupid that I don't want to do? You know, I know who I am. I know what I do for a living. I know what my family looks like. It's not great. I need a lot of room for improvement. But we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects. What's on the other side of that, man? I don't know what's on the other side of that. That's why it separates the men from the boys. That's a big step here. So here's what I do know, though, is that you people have done this stuff. You've done it. You're okay. You're not Hare Krishnas. You're not going out proselytizing. You're not grabbing people and telling them what they got to do with their lives. You're not, you know. You seem to still make mistakes in your life. You're not pure as gold, whatever, you know. That's what I know. How do I know it's going to happen to me? Because I see what's happened to you. That's how I know. So, but you know, there it is true. You've probably heard that there's two things that alcoholics can't stand. One is change, and the other is the way things are. So I don't want to change, right? I'm at the meeting one night, and this guy, this lawyer who's been sober a long time, who I respect a lot, we must be talking about this step. Because I never forget, I remember where he was sitting. I can kind of remember even the other people around the table. And he says, you know, Dave, there's two ways to change. One is by pain, and the other is by prayer. And I swear I had no idea that prayer was an alternative to pain. I had so much freaking pain that I didn't know that prayer was another way to change things. I had no idea. So I'm looking at the shelf, my resentments, I hate her. I hate her more than anybody has ever hated an ex-spouse. I hate that guy who moved into my house. I hate those lawyers who screwed me over. I hate those people who are calling me all the time for their money. I hate the IRS. I'm not drinking, and I'm full of all this hate, and I'm petrified. I'm scared. I've got all these fears. I fear I'll never make another nickel. I'm afraid my life is going to be consigned to be doing nothing but going to AA meetings. I'm afraid of my kids will never talk to me again. I'm just afraid of everything in terms of sexual dysfunction. You know, I know what I did in the past, but, you know, like Chuck says, the well is pretty dry at the present time when I'm a couple years sober. But he says that can all be diminished. All that stuff that's eating you up can be diminished by this step and the next step. So in our step action group, When we get a list of all this stuff that's eaten us up, we suggest to people they put a number 1 to 10 on it. Is it a 10 in your life? Do you hate her that much? Is that a 10? Is it an 8? What is it? Is it a 2 now? How about those fears you have of not eating again tomorrow? You know, you'll never have enough money to have a, you know, is that a 10? Is that a 7? Rate these things that you've come up with, all these character defects you have. And take 2 of them. Take 3 of them. And use 6 and 7 on them. Become entirely ready to have God remove your fear of being broke for the rest of your life. Become entirely ready to have God remove this terrible hatred that you wake up with every morning of that woman that you were married to. You know? Become entirely, you know. What good is it? What good am I if I'm walking around with all that stuff? I have a sponsor, a guy who's since moved out of town, but I talk to him occasionally. His name is Brian, and he's sober maybe 25 years. And Brian, today, as well as the first year we got together, he's always working on something. How you doing, Brian? Good. I'm seeing a therapist, and I'm working on my anger with my boy, my son. You know, he doesn't call me. Oh, you're working on that. Yeah. Next time we talk, I'm working on this idea. I never can hold a job, Dave, and I'm working on that. This step is exactly the opposite of that. This is not something that we grab and wrestle into the ground and whatever. This is another step we throw in the towel, just like the first step, right? Throw in the towel. Stop fighting this, Dave. Stop fighting that anger you have. Stop fighting that resentment you have. We're entirely ready to have God remove, not the therapist, not you, have God remove these defects of character. I have found, for me, all this, I tell you about all this problem I've had with all these steps, and all this pain I've had with all these steps in AA. What it really boils down, honestly, what it is the pain is, for me, has been in the resistance to taking the steps. The steps themselves have not been very painful at all, actually. They've given me relief. But I could come up with a reason why not to take a step. And in terms of becoming entirely ready, a friend Ray, who Chuck alluded to, used to talk about planting seeds. He loved the garden. So in the spring, he would go out and he would get his hoe and his rake. And he would go to the dirt and he would take out the stones that had come up during the winter. And he would break up the lumps. And he would put some fertilizer in and maybe some peat moss in. And he was getting that entirely ready to have God do his job. And then he would put the seeds in and let God do his job. And that's kind of what we do in step six. We become entirely ready. We've done the work of 1 through 5. That's a lot of work, right? And by this time, I know I'm a member of AA. I'm a card-carrying member of AA. I've taken some pretty hard steps. I've found out a lot of truth about myself. It's just pretty difficult to swallow. But I don't want to feel like this anymore. And I'm looking at you people, and you've got smiles on your faces. And you have ex-spouses. And you've got kids, maybe talk to you, or maybe they don't. And you've got a job, and maybe you don't. But you know, you're in AA. We do this thing together, you tell me. And you say to me, Dave, you're going to be okay. Just do what we do. This book is a report of actions that these people took before we got here. So we did it. And you're going to be okay. So with that knowledge that I'm in a group of people that do this thing together, that I cannot do this stuff alone, I become entirely ready at least to feel better about myself, right? I don't want all this crap on those shelves. I don't. I know what's on those shelves now. I know what kind of person I am. And I'm willing to have that sort of stuff that's eating me up in those three categories diminished. If not taken away, at least made less. And with that willingness and what the seventh step, which we'll talk about when we come back from the break, I can report to you that this thing works. It really does. Thanks. We're going to take a 20-minute break. And 8 and 9, and then I'm going to do 8 and 9, and then we're going to break for dinner. So, step 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The 12 and 12 talks about this idea of humility for pretty much the whole chapter. What is it? How do we get it? Whatever. You probably heard the story about the group that gave their oldest, soberest member a humility pin. And the meeting, the first meeting he wore it to, they took it away. So it's kind of an elusive principle. Or as somebody said to me once, Dave, you've got a lot of humility. I said, you ever think so? He said, yeah, you should. You've never used any. So here's how you get enough humility to do this seventh step. You drink too much and your life becomes a mess. You get to AA. You recognize that you've got a disease that's going to kill you. you ask and search for some sort of power that's bigger than your alcoholism. You ask that power to get involved in your life, an alcoholic's life, get involved in my life, take care of me. You inventory all the lousy crap you've done in your life, and the worst kind of person you are, and you admit that to God and yourself and another human being, so you know what's on the shelf of your life. And then finally, you throw in the towel on all these character defects and say, I don't want to feel this way anymore. You know, I cannot fight this anymore. I'm throwing in the towel. I need your help. And if you've done those things, those previous six steps, you've got enough humility to ask God to diminish these problems in your life. And remember, what we're looking for here is the spiritual awakening. We're on, you know, we're halfway in our steps to have a profound change in the way we react to life, which is our spiritual awakening. And you people have done it before me. And I've heard it said that humility is not something that's really like such a fantastically hard principle to come to grips with. It's nothing more than a middle ground between grandiosity and shame. Right? When I come into AA, I am like, I'm a man of extremes. I'm either the best or the worst. And I'm never in the middle ground. And you people are telling me there's a good place in the middle ground. Even for egomaniacs like you, Dave. You know? And so when I hear this humility, oh, it's got to be like that. I got to be the best, or I got to be the holiest, or people got to see how humble. No, it's just the middle ground between grandiosity, which is me, and shame, which is me. So humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. What does that mean? I know what my shortcomings are. I'm willing to have them taken away or diminished. I'm willing because they're killing me. They're eating me up. I don't know how long I'm going to be able to not drink with all these things killing me here. So I have this image of trying to go to work, back in my car out of the driveway, and in the driveway is a baseball glove and a wagon and a tricycle and a bicycle and all this stuff that the kids left behind. My car. I can't get to work because I got him. So I get out of the car and I take him and I put him by the side of the driveway. Right? I don't put him in the garbage can. I don't throw him out. I just put him by the side of the driveway enough so I can get to work. I can get on with my life. And that's kind of how I look at the seventh step. Now, maybe some of this stuff will be gone forever. Maybe this hatred I had for my ex-wife, more hatred than anybody has ever had for their ex-wife, I can tell you that that is gone. And I'll tell you a little bit about 8 and 9 on her. But that's gone. So when I pushed that hatred through 6 and 7, I'm willing to have that go. It's just killing me. I wake up every morning with this knot in my stomach, and I just, it's so unfair, and I just, but it's killing me. I get, can you get involved in this? You know, and my first sponsor said, Dave, here's the prayer. I don't know what you do, and I don't know how you do it, but I know you don't want me to feel this way. So whatever you do, and however you do it, please do it to take care of this for me. You know, I don't have any, I'm on my own, I'm going to hang on to that hatred. I'm going to hang on to that fear. I know that because I have experience hanging on to these things. But you people have pushed your hatred and your fear and your anger, your resentments and your sexual dysfunction. You pushed it through these 2 steps, 6 and 7. You've prayed for the willingness. You've gotten the willingness. And then you've thrown in the towel and said, please help me on this. I don't know how you do it or what you do, but I know you don't want me to feel this way. I know that. You didn't get me sober to feel this way. To have all these defects of character. So now, by this time, by 6 and 7, I have a new menu of my reactions to life. Right? When I get in here, what are my reactions to life? Madness, anger, anxiety, fear, resentment. I've got terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, discontented, restlessness. But now I have some other things that have been given to me because this other part of me, this shelf of dysfunction, has been diminished. So now I get patience, a little bit of patience, a little bit of tolerance, a little bit of kindliness toward my kids and my wife. Maybe I know, I'm starting to experience a little bit about what this idea of love is. Get a little bit of forgiveness, of honesty, of willingness. I'll tell you a little thing about love that I have found out. I have 8 grandchildren. One is 1 year old and the oldest is 18. Before I had 8 grandchildren, I had 7 grandchildren, right? When this 8th grandchild came along, this little girl, it became clear to me that I loved her just as much as I loved the other 7. No more, no less. Completely. I love her. And so I thought to myself, maybe that's what the higher power does. Maybe he loves us all. There's so much love that he has an equal amount for each one of us. And just because another person stumbles into AA doesn't take away any of the love that he has for the rest of us. Maybe that's the way the higher power works. And that was a very comforting thought to me. Because I know what that love is for those kids. So now I'm moving closer to that vision we talked about, this ideal. Now that we were familiar with those character defects, those bedevilments on page 52, all those things that just drive us crazy even when we're not drinking. And we put down the kind of person I want to be when I'm on the other side of those bedevilments. When I push my character defects through 6 and 7, ask God to get involved, ask God to take care of these things for me, but I can't do it myself. And I wake up in the morning and I start to look at my life and start to think that, well, maybe what I want is not that important. Maybe I can be useful today. Maybe with God's help, I can stay sober and maybe reach out my hand to another alcoholic. Maybe I'll have the willingness to go to a meeting. Maybe I'm changing the way I live. Maybe I'm asking my wife on a daily basis, which I started years ago. I don't know, I must have got this from another AA. Years ago, I started saying to my wife in the morning, what can I do for you today? At the beginning, she had a lot of stuff for me to do. Now you know what she says to me? What can I do for you, Dave? I've turned the tables on her. She didn't even know it. That's different, man. That's a different menu of my life. I can still have the old reactions to life. I can still, easily. But now I can turn the page. Because I know about these other reactions to life. You showed me that. You showed me how you react to your sadness, to your pain, to your disappointments, whatever. You don't react the same way as you did when you were drinking, or even when you were first sober. You've got a different way to live. Seven-step prayer is the following. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing, whenever I say this prayer, now, this morning, that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray you now remove from me every single defective care which stands in character, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. So in the morning when I wake up, and we'll talk about this in a couple of steps from now, but I say that 7-step prayer. I say that 3rd-step prayer. And I say that 7-step prayer. And I put the emphasis on now. I need it now. You know, when I wake up, I need it now. I ask God to direct my thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest and self-seeking motives, especially. But then I ask him to get involved in my life now. Now, here's what I believe today. We read it at the end of almost every meeting when we read the first 3 pages of How It Works. A, B, C. We were alcoholic, could not manage our own lives. B, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, God could and would if he were sought. I believe that 100% because I have experienced that. I have faith in that. That I cannot manage my own life. God could and would if he were sought. I seek him. Now, in the morning. Get in here. I need your help, man, today. I need your help every day. You know? There's that drink sitting somewhere out there. It's already been distilled. I don't want to go there. You know, I don't want to do that. So that's my experience with seven. Thanks a lot.
So the sixth step is the step that separates the men from the boys. And, you know, to be politically correct, that should be what separates the adults from the children. So what is an adult? And an adult is someone who can set boundaries, set limits, say no, and think of others. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was incapable of doing any of those things. I had no boundaries, none. If I wanted to be in your life, I just went into it. It didn't matter whether you said you wanted me or didn't. It was irrelevant. If I wanted to do it, I did it. I was unable to set limits. I couldn't say, I will tolerate this much behavior. You cannot go beyond that. I didn't know how to do that. They were imaginary boundaries and imaginary limits. I couldn't say no. I was afraid if I said no that you would reject me, that you wouldn't want me, that you would leave me, that I would be left alone. And I was incapable of thinking of others. That's the bondage of self. All teenagers suffer from the bondage of self. They're not adults. You know, back in the third step, we asked God, to remove fear, we asked him what he would have us be. And see if I can find that. I think what he wants us to be is a Boy Scout. Honest, clean, brave, reverent, cheerful. All of these good characteristics. I was none of those. I had none of those when I came here. I could talk about them. I could tell you that I was aspiring to live that way. I could defend the fact that I would live that way, but you wouldn't let me. But the truth is, I couldn't. I didn't have the tools. I didn't know how to do it. And I'm getting those tools in the fourth, fifth, sixth steps. And the sixth step brought me to my knees. And the humility in that sixth step is that I can't change. I can't do it. I need to have another power. I need more power. I told you before about those volts. I was stuck at 75. You can't make 75 volts 110. You can't. Adults run at that 110 volt level. I couldn't get there. So life was very frustrating. That's why I was filled with terror and bewilderment, frustration and despair. When I got here, I thought that was because of the booze. The booze was just a symptom. I lived that way because the reality of life was closing in around me. And that reality was that I was unable to live successfully as an adult in this world. I had lots of degrees. I had lots of things that I could point to tell you that that wasn't true. But I couldn't escape the reality anymore. And these steps revealed this to me. And I saw in that fourth, fifth, and sixth step why I was bound by self. And I had to admit that I can't change this. I need this power. I think that the steps, Bill Wilson was once asked about the steps, and he said they're not steps up to sobriety, they're steps down to humility. And this step process has took me down to that place where I couldn't, it was inescapable, I could no longer live and believe that I could manage my life. I knew that I could not do it on my own. And I knew that second pertinent idea, that no human power could change that. I'd spent my life looking for a human power to change that. In women, in my family, in psychotherapists, in partners, and employers. I wanted some human power to change me, and they can't. Not that they don't want to. There are probably a lot of them that wanted to, but they couldn't because they can't. And so my alcoholism is a manifestation of these horrible negative emotions and immature behaviors. So when we say that no human power, probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism, it was much more than taking a drink. I've gone to, every once in a while I speak at a rehab, and I'll ask them, Dave and I did this the other night, I'll ask them, let's make alcoholism. I got a beaker here. Let's make alcoholism. What are we going to put in it? They put in fear, anxiety, anger, rage, pissed off, everything you can imagine. I mean, after everybody in the room has put something in there, and this has never failed, after everyone in the room has put something in there, I point out to them, what's not in there? And they say, what? They don't know. I say, alcohol. Not one of them puts alcohol in when they're making alcoholism. And we know the reason why. Because when you put alcoholism in there, put alcohol in there, what happens? Poof. It all goes away, right? So, I can't change that. And I need to have this power change it. Bill says that attainment of greater humility is a foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. And in each of these steps, I was taken down to that place where I could see that I wasn't doing it, that some other power was. He says, we have passionately clung to the belief that to satisfy our basic natural desires is the main object of life. We have been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. Now, in the 12 and 12, in the seventh step, they say that there are three emotions. There are only three emotions that an alcoholic has ever experienced. Excitement, depression, and anxiety. That's it. I thought I felt love. It was excitement. When I got that love, I became depressed or anxious because it wasn't what I thought it was going to be, or because I immediately found someone and the next day was looking for the next victim. And I was anxious that I would get caught. And then the relationship would end and I would sink into that depression, and I knew the way out of that depression was more excitement. So I would look for someone else. I did that with alcohol, all of these external things. I chased excitement. I thought that was going to give me peace. It could only bring me depression and anxiety. Those are the only three emotions that I had ever experienced. And when I first read that, I thought that's a little far-fetched, Bill. But the more that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I've had an opportunity to look at my story, look at my life, and to hear the stories of others, it is this endless cycle of excitement, depression, and anxiety. And I just kept chasing it. And I didn't know how to break out of that because I was bound by myself. The 12 and 12 also says that we not only want more of whatever we thought we wanted. It says that we demanded that. And Bill says in the book, the difference between a demand and a simple request is evident. Now, I read that for years, and I didn't know what the difference between a demand and a suggestion, a simple request. I didn't know the difference. I didn't know what they were. But I understand what it is now. When I tried to ask for something, I had an agenda. And if I didn't get it, I was outraged. That's a demand. I would pose it as a simple request. Would you mind giving me a ride? And if someone said no, I'd go crazy. If they said yes, I wouldn't be satisfied because they weren't going to get there at the right time, or they weren't going to, whatever it was. But I was demanding that. A simple request, you ask, and whatever the answer is, it is. They say no, you ask someone else. Or you say, can you help me find a ride? Whatever. They might say no. Whatever the answer is, yes or no, or maybe, it doesn't eat me alive. All I did in my whole life was demand. I had no idea how to make a simple request. None. So this is a road to humility. We have to gain a new perspective. For us, the process was unbelievably painful. If it was 5 miles into that woods, it's going to be 5 miles out. And I believe that what that means is that all of those situations in which I reacted in a way that caused pain to myself and to the people around me, I have to be faced with them again in sobriety. And I'll be repeatedly faced with them until I change, until I react differently. Now, the spiritual awakening that Bill talks about in the Appendix 2 is that we have a profound alteration in our reaction to life. And so I had to be in those same situations and react differently. And what I found out was that I reacted the same, even though I wasn't drinking, even though I was a member of AA, even though I had a home group, even though I had service positions in that home group, even though I sponsored people, even though I had a sponsor. Because what was still missing was my reliance on God. I was still trying to manage the whole show, and the only way I know how to react to something is the way that I know how to react to it. This is not rocket science. The only things that I can know are what I know. What I knew was what I saw in my family when I was growing up and how I interpreted that, whether or not it was accurate, but how I interpreted that. And what I knew was my experiences in the academic world and in the business world. What I knew were my experiences and relationships with women, and I couldn't change. I could only do what I knew how to do. With the help of my sponsor, and with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to get suggestions on how to live a different way. And that, I believe, was evidence for me of the higher power. That I was finally broken to that point, humble enough to listen and to take a chance and to try to do something differently, and got famous, unbelievable results when I did that. Because what I was learning was how to set boundaries, set limits, say no, and to think of others. So when I got to AA, I was terrified to go to work. I was trying to practice law again. I was terrified. And I hated my boss. And my marriage was ending. I failed at everything that I ever tried to do in my life. All that I wanted was to be happily married and to enjoy my work. Couple years into sobriety, I couldn't take it anymore. I was going to quit, and I went in. I met with Dave, and I was going to tell him that I'm quitting that day. I know that you never quit a job unless you have another one, but I can't be in this guy's presence another minute. I hate him. This is, a healthy member of Alcoholics Anonymous saying these things. And I tell Dave, I said, I have to quit the job. I can't stay there. And I'm ready. I'm braced. I know that Dave has never raised his voice. It's always only been kind, but I know this is going to take him over the edge. And he says, that's great. I said, what? He says, that's great. He says, I need someone. I'm looking for a lawyer to come and work for me. Do you want to come over here and work with me? And it's unbelievable. What I thought was going to be this horrible situation, by being honest about where I was in my life and about what was going on, I got a completely different result. It was unbelievable. And we practiced law side by side from July 29th, 1991, until Dave retired 7 years prematurely. I also told them shortly after that how I really wanted to have a relationship, and I was just getting nowhere. I tried and it wasn't working, and he said that, well, the only thing I can tell you is what they say in AA is if you really want something, you got to let it go. And so I thought about that, and I asked God for help with that. And I did. I let it go. I stopped thinking about relationships. I got really involved in AA. I got involved in our law practice. I sponsored a host of men. I got back involved in my church that I had left when I was an atheist for the second time. I had a whole life, and it didn't matter. It didn't matter. I wasn't looking for a relationship anymore. I knew one thing for sure. I would never marry anyone from AA. That was not going to happen. I had dated some women in AA. It was unsuccessful. So I go to a picnic for Memorial Day in 1992, and I sit down next to this beautiful woman, and it turns out she was sober almost 3 years. I was sober almost 3 years. One thing led to another. There were no moving vans for 6 months. Mostly because of her. But we got married. We got married in the fall of 1993. On my wedding day, I was presented with a 10-year-old son, which is an unbelievable gift. And then we had two daughters. So when my youngest daughter was born, I was in the morning I had my routine, and I would sit down and I would say my routine. And one of the things I do is I recite the 7-step prayer. And the 7-step prayer, says I offer myself, I offer myself to you, all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And she would start crying right in the middle of that prayer. Just a minute, I got to reset this ticker here. She would start praying right in the middle, start crying in the middle of that prayer. And I would think to myself, well, my wife, Sue better get up. You know, if she wants to have a husband who's spiritual, she better get up and take care of that baby. You know what? I can't have this disrupting my spiritual exercises. Now, I didn't know this when I got married, but I did learn this in the course of our children growing up, and that's that my wife, Sue, is a very rare disease. It's called nocturnal deafness. And what that means is between the hours of 11 o'clock at night and 7 o'clock in the morning, she can't hear a baby cry, or at least not before I hear that baby cry. And so I got up. I would get up, and I get my daughter, and I feed her, and I finish my readings and stuff. And this went on like every day for several weeks. And I thought, what's going on here? This is crazy. You know, how can she do it every day? Right, that same spot in that prayer, she does the same thing. How can that possibly be? So one day I pick her up. I'm feeding her. I do these other readings, and in the reading, it's the master's talking to his follower, and he says to his follower, he says, "Do you love me?" And the follower says, "Yeah, sure, you know I love you." He asks him, and then he says, "Feed my sheep." And then he says to him again, he says, "Do you love me?" He says, "Sure, I love you. Of course I do. We're best of friends." He says, "Tend my lambs." He asks him a third time, "Do you love me?" He says, "Yes, I love you." He says, "Feed my sheep." And I look down in my arms, and I got this little baby, this little lamb. And I'm just doing what he's telling me to do. Because you see, the defect of character is removed when I'm thinking of others. There's nothing I can do about it. I cannot want to lie. I cannot want to cheat. But if with his power, if I think of others, all of those horrible things go away. They do just what Dave said. They're just put on the side of the driveway. And they'll stay there so long as I think of others. And I need his power to do that. Amazingly, after that morning, She never woke up again at that time during my praying. But I think what he was telling me was, if I really want to be useful to him and others, I've got to do it now, not on my schedule, not on my time. So when people call, I need to take their calls. When people need help, I need to help them. My mind always tells me 10 minutes from now, 15 minutes from now, I'll do it tomorrow. So the seventh step, I think, is the humility is really understanding that not only do I need God's help, but it's there and he will give it to me anytime I want it. So we've now been relieved of the bondage of self. The prayer began with the third step prayer. It ends with the amen and the seventh step prayer. In between, God relieves us of the bondage of self. The eighth and ninth step are designed to remove our fear of others. We get freedom from the fear of others. The eighth step says we must make a list of the people we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. So I knew the people I had harmed. I knew that from a lot of it from the fourth step list. But when I wrote the fourth step list, I didn't know that there were people I had harmed until I completed that. Until I completed that list and sent that out and got to that fourth column. The fourth column showed that I harmed them, that they weren't harming me. So I had a list of people I had harmed, but then I had to see how I harmed them. And the book is okay. It has some examples of what harm is. But if you really want to understand what harm is, I suggest that you spend time with the eighth step in the 12 and 12. And that really, that outlines what harm means, what it really means. Like a persistent negative attitude is harmful. Well, I was always negative. You were harmed just being in my presence because I didn't know how to present things positively. I didn't know how to present things with love. I was always telling you why things couldn't work out. I was always predicting doom. And I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. But the book says that's harmful. We're miserly. We had this guy, Billy Ross, and he said, used to say, I don't care who you are. Billy Ross was like a street person. He had never had any money. He got sober. He had a wonderful program, but he never made any money. And he'd sit there at the Abbott Men's Group on Saturday morning. His t-shirt would be yellow from the nicotine stains. His hands would be even yellower from the nicotine stains. And in those days, you could smoke, and he'd be smoking his rolled cigarette, and he'd be shaking, and he'd say, I don't care who you are. If you owe somebody 10 cents, until you pay that back, you're spending their money. God, I hated that, because I knew I owed people a lot of money. So I eventually got to the point where I make this list. And on the list, of course, is my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, all my family members. Some close friends, all of my employers, all of the women that I had ever dated, and then I started listing the people that I owed money to, and I owed a lot of money, and I wrote down this list, and I sort of estimated what I needed in terms of money, and you know how to go about that, and I get done with it. Now I'm pretty good at mental math. And this list was so long and the number was so great, I just couldn't add it up in my head. I actually had to get a calculator. So I write the whole thing down and I get this number. And I look at it and I'm like shocked. And I think to myself, what the heck? I got sobers? I'm going to spend the whole rest of my life working to pay off this debt. I will never get it paid off. And this voice says to me, well, so what, Chuck? You're sober. And I realized that was it. So what? I'm sober. And at that moment, I got the willingness to make those amends. Because it didn't matter. I had a roof over my head. I had clothes on my body. I had food in the refrigerator. My needs were met. And that's really sort of been my mantra. On those nights when I wake up and I'm in fear and something bad's going to happen, I ask myself those questions. Does your family have clothing? Is there food in the refrigerator? Is there a roof over our heads? If I can answer yes to those three things, boy, then everything's okay. The rest of it's just a luxury. I heard Dave say this once, and I really like it a lot. He's talking, you know, what I have by the grace of God. And I understand that freedom from the obsession to drink was removed by God's grace, and the freedom from bondage of self was removed by God's grace, and the freedom from the fear of others was removed by God's grace. And it's just like today, if it's like showering out there, that rain, but it's like a warm rain of grace. And I walk around with an umbrella. And I got the umbrella up, open. And I'm mad at God because he's not giving me the grace. All I got to do is close that umbrella. And I'm showered with that grace. And that love is here for all of us. But I just want to push it away. That's what I know how to do. AA has taught me how to close that umbrella and to accept that love and to let it flow through me into the people that I see and to look into the eyes of everyone that I know and see that power. No matter how much pain they're in, no matter how horrible their circumstances seem, I know that that power is inside of them and that power can help them. So I got the willingness to make those amends. I had a list of the people I had harmed and the institutions. I mean, I stole money from employers, from businesses. And I became willing to make those amends. So I sat down with Dave. And I recommend that anyone, whoever does this, the book recommends it, that you talk about this with another person who knows you, preferably your sponsor. Because I'd looked over the list and I sort of had a game plan on this. You know, my mother was dead. I hated my father. I probably would never make amends to that SOB. I wasn't going to bother with him. But and my sister I would make an amend to, although I couldn't see how I'd really harmed her. I put her name on that list only because I was told to list all my family members. She was 9 years younger than me. I adored her. She trusted me implicitly. She just followed me around. She really trusted me. We had a really nice relationship. I put her name on there just because I put her name on there. I was told to do that. It's going to be a good member of AA. My brother, we'd had a rough relationship, but you know, I'd be willing to make amends to him. But my game plan, I thought, was I got all of these women. That, you know, I was not very good in relationships. I was more or less on the, you know, predator, selfish side of this thing. I didn't really give a lot. So I really should go back and make amends to them. And I thought that would be a good place to start. Now, bear in mind, I was in the middle of a divorce and it had been a long season without rain. It's possible that that thinking was a product of a mind with no blood in it. But nevertheless, I presented this to my sponsor, and he looked at it, he listened nicely, nodded his head. Okay. He said, well, I just have one question. I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, what was the last thing these women said to you? I said, well, they said that they never wanted to see me again. He said, maybe that's the amend. So my plans were thwarted. But 10 days after I'd made this list and shortly after I'd sat down with Dave, my father-in-law from my first marriage passed away. And he was a very wealthy man. And he loved me dearly. And he'd named me the executor in his will, and even though his daughter and I were divorcing, he had continued that relationship and continued to seek my counsel as a lawyer. But he named me the executor. And the executor's commissions, my share of the executor's commissions in that will, were within a few dollars of what that number was on that eight-step list. And I thought I'd have to work all of my life to pay back those amends. Now, I don't recommend marrying wealthy people and hoping their parents die. It just happened to work out that way for me. But the miracle in this thing was not that that happened. The miracle was that when I got the money, I actually paid them back. That's when I knew that there was an unbelievable power in this world. Because all along the way, I'd had times when I lived in abject poverty. I was lived as an ascetic. I didn't have any times when I didn't have any money. But there are also times when I did have money. And it would cross my mind that maybe I should pay some of these people back. But this other thought would intervene and say, well, no, not yet. You need the money more than they do. And I always listened to that other voice. And I would see them and I would be embarrassed and I would make excuses and say I was sorry and promise to pay them. I didn't call any of them up and say, hey, I've been named an executor, I'm going to pay you back. I didn't do anything until I got the money. And then I went and I paid them back. And it was unbelievable what happened. This man, Eddie, who had taken care of me for a year after I hit that bottom in New York, I called him. And he heard my voice. He started crying on the phone. He said, thank God you're alive. Where have you been? And I told him, and I said I was in recovery, and I had this check, and I was going to come down and pay him. And he said, you know, it's not about the money. He said, I always knew you'd pay me back. That wasn't it. But he said, I missed you. I loved you. I didn't know what happened to you. Thank God you're okay. I went down, I made that amend, and about 7 months later, I call him up. And he gets on the phone, and he's crying. He says, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I said, hey, what's wrong? What are you sorry about? He says, I'm sorry, my son Barry was shot in cold blood. A tenant in an apartment he owned shot him in the head 6 times while he was on his knees begging for his life. He says, I didn't know how to call and tell you that Barry was dead. I'm so sorry. I thought, my God, that was the depth of his love for me. And I would have walked away from that and died and not known that love. That little sister of mine, the one who I'd never harm, the one who I love so much, I introduced her to drugs. I introduced her to alcohol. I encouraged promiscuity. I told her to quit college, that she could just educate herself and not spend the money on that college. I did a lot of things to that little girl, and she just trusted me. Whatever I told her to do, she did it. I didn't think I'd harmed her. The person up to that point in my life, to my recovery, that I thought I'd love the most was the person I had harmed beyond belief. And I was able to make that amend. I was able to talk to her about that. To tell her I was wrong. And let her know that whatever I could do to help make that up, I'd be willing to do that. That's the power. Man, that's the power. So the one amend I knew that I would never make, that there was no need for me to make it, was to my dad. I had put my mother on a great pedestal. And as high as I had her, I had my father that low. And my mother, I went to her grave, and I made an amend to her for that, that was wrong. No one should ever be placed in that position in anyone's life. And that it was wrong to do that. And it was a wonderful healing experience at her gravesite. But my dad was still alive. I called him up. He lived in Tennessee, and I called him, and I told him a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told him that I was calling to tell him that I was sorry that I had not been a very good son. That as a result of this program, I had learned about myself, and that I was not a good son. I was mad at him all of my life, and I was angry, and I never gave him an opportunity to be the kind of dad that he probably could have been. Now, remember, I'm not sober yet, a full year when I'm doing this. So I expected him to say, well, I wasn't a very good dad either, Chuck. You know, I was a son of a bitch, and I was about... But he listened to me, and he said, thank you for telling me that. He said, I always knew there was something wrong with you. But I didn't know what it was. He said, I couldn't figure out why you were mad. He said, you always seemed so mad to me, and I couldn't understand why that was the way you reacted to life. But I'm glad you found something and it's helping you. Glad to hear that. How's the weather? So we finished the conversation, and at the end of the conversation, I hear these words come out of my mouth. I say, I love you, Dad. I hang up. I think, where the hell, where did that come from? And every time we talked, at the end of the conversation, I would say, I love you, Dad. And after 3 or 4 years, I actually started loving him. And he lived a long time. He lived until just a couple years ago, 3 years ago. And we ended up having a wonderful relationship. And I love my dad, and he's with me all the time. My mom is with me. All these people who die, they don't go away. They're with us. They're more of the power. And that's the fellowship of the Spirit. Bill's here today. Bob's here today. You can count on that. So, at the end of this step, I didn't think there was a power anymore, man. I knew that there was. And I had made amends to those people I had harmed. And I was freed. I was freed. I could walk down that street, and I don't have fear of other people anymore. That third great freedom was enough for me. Boy, that it went from believing there was a power, or having faith that there was a power, to knowing that there was one. And I know that that power is with me every minute of every day of my life. And when I don't feel it, it's only because I've turned the other way. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Chuck. Very powerful. Very, very powerful.
So now we're in more hard steps for an alcoholic. I mean, the list is just a list, right? We had a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. It's just a list. That's what they told me. You don't have to do anything, Dave. Just put the credit. Who do you owe money to? Your family members, the people you worked with. Start there. You can go in reach for neighbors and whatever, college roommates and whatever that's just good. But just start with it. People you owe money to, the people you've worked with, and your family members. Put those down on a list. I could do that. I didn't have to do anything about it. They're just names on a piece of paper. The second part of it is a little tougher. I became willing to make amends to them all. And now, the bridge between this 8-step and this 9-step of actually making amends is something called forgiveness. You know, I've got all these that says you've got a list to start. If you want to start, use your 4-step list of the people you resent. And the reason for that is because you had a part in each one of those. And you found that out on that 4th column of the 4th step. What was my part in this failed marriage? What was this part in my daughter not talking to me? What was this part in these people firing me? What was my part? You know? So But still, you know, she doesn't talk to me. And still, she really took me for a ride. And still, you know. So you got to forgive, Dave. So I don't know how to forgive. I mean, I was raised a Roman Catholic, and I know when you went to confession, it's said that the priest has some sort of magical power to forgive your sins. But I don't even know how that works. I don't get it. So what we passed out here today is a little forgiveness prayer. And what I can tell you is that this thing works. So if there is somebody who's taken up a lot of space in your head and your stomach and your heart, who really worked you over, and you know if you want to stay sober, you've got to address that sooner or later. What I'm suggesting to you is that you can forgive them. Well, no, I can't. Yes, you can. And here's how. This is this little prayer that we passed out. Now, this comes out of a book called The Sermon on the Mount, which is a book that Bill and Bob read. It was written by a guy named Emmett Fox. And he says forgiveness is no big deal. It's not hard. Now, I didn't even know where would you begin to forgive someone? Well, he says it's not hard. So he says, first, become willing to believe that the resentment you feel is not in anyone's best interest. Become willing for it to go away, knowing how much your own forgiveness is attached to this process. So he says, say this willingness prayer. Can you read this on step one? Can we read that together, the willingness prayer? God, take me to a place where I'm gladly ready to let this go. Now, everybody in this room, myself included, there is somebody taking a little space up here that has recently, or maybe a long time ago, done something to hurt me. So let's all think of that person. Maybe somebody at work, maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's a child. Now it says, find a quiet place and relax. And we have a quiet place to relax right here. Then it says, say a prayer that you like. Third step prayer, seventh step prayer, serenity prayer, Lord's prayer. Let's say the serenity prayer together. God, bring the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now we're going to say this next prayer quietly, but we're going to say it out loud. And in that blank, you are going to put the name of that person that you know somewhere along the line you have to forgive if you're ever going to go to them and make things square. So let's say that prayer. I fully and freely forgive. I loose him and let him go. I completely forgive the whole business in question. As far as I am concerned, it is finished forever. I cast the burden of resentment upon the God within me. That person is free now. I am free too. I wish him well in every phase of his life. That incident is finished. The truth has set us both free. Thank God. Lastly, do not repeat the prayer. If the person or event comes to your mind again, say a prayer for his well-being and put it out of your mind. So, you've done that now. And see what happens. See how you feel tomorrow about that person or that event. If you know somebody, your sponsor, somebody who's having a tough time, really struggling with a hatred or a resentment or whatever, give them this thing. This works. If you don't want to forgive somebody, don't push it through this prayer. Because this thing works. You will be relieved of your hatred or your resentment for the person by using this. I say that because it's happened to me over and over and over. So, there we are. I have a friend in Florida who says we have a contract. Everybody has trouble with the eighth and ninth step. Everybody does. But he says, you know, we have a contract here. It says in our book, we agreed at the beginning that we would go to any length to overcome alcoholism. We agreed. That's a contract. I'll go to any length. You keep me away from that next drink. You know, and this is part of the any length. This willingness and this taking this step. Could we pause there?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to just pause a minute. When Derek starts again, we'll...